Yes, we have no bananas. We have no bananas today.
Big blue skulls, purple shawls, big blue bulls, big blue bulls, let's make little blue evil.
Welcome to Farce Perspective, a podcast about the last 50 years of comedy. On key anniversaries, we look back and ask, what was innovative material then? What continues to be successful now? And what have people thought about it along the way?
I'm Ben.
I'm Pete.
And welcome to The Henson Perspective, where we're talking about an episode of The Muppet Show that was broadcast 45 years ago in New York City. And today our focus is on the 18th production episode of Series 2, the J.P. Morgan episode, which originally aired on March 6th, 1978. This, Pete, you like to do a little count at the end of the episode of things Ben hasn't seen.
Yes.
This episode was a thing Ben hasn't seen. And so me being tasked with doing trivia on J.P. Morgan was a new and interesting stretch, considering that I'd never heard of her. I hadn't watched this episode, and so it was all new as far as I was concerned.
Hey, Ben?
Yeah?
I'm still in that boat, except I have seen this episode twice now.
Yes.
But from my perspective, doing trivia for this should have been one of the easiest trivias ever, because you could literally ask me, is she an actress or a singer, and I'd have to guess.
Well, we'll get to that, of course, very quickly, because while there is a runner to this episode, I don't think it's one worth talking about in isolation.
I don't think it's possible to talk about it in isolation.
So we're going to do five trivia questions about the career and life of J.P. Morgan, and then we are going to do a rundown of the episode before moving into accumulated statistics about the episode and our five favorite moments. So let us cut to the chase. That's Chase Morgan as opposed to J.P. Morgan.
I was going
to
say, thanks George W. Bush for having his Supreme Court declare corporations are people. So you can say, I'm going to ask you questions about this person / corporation.
Question number one. J.P. Morgan was born in 1931 to a musical family. Mary Margaret Morgan tells the story multiple times that she was teasingly called J.P. Morgan after the financier in grade school. And then she kept this as a stage name after graduating from high school and going on to become a solo performer. Prior to that, she had performed as Mary Morgan and had been part of the Morgan Family Singers. She was hired as the featured singer as J.P. Morgan for the Frank Duval Orchestra at age 18 and released albums by age 22 with that organization. She is often listed in her biographies as having sung three popular hits. I'm going to list them now. Which of the three of them was her highest chart ranker? A. Life is Just a Bowl of Cherries from 1953. B. That's All I Want from You from 1954. Or C. Are You Lonesome Tonight from 1959.
A.
Incorrect. Life is Just a Bowl of Cherries hit number 26 in 1954. It does have a number of Muppet performer connections. It was first introduced in 1931 by Ethel Merman. It appears in the Steve Martin film Pennies from Heaven in 1981, and it is sung by Ben Vereen when it opens the musical Fosse in 1999. But her major hit was That's All I Want From You, which was number 3 in 1954. Curiously, Are You Lonesome Tonight, she recorded in 1959, right before Elvis recorded it in 1960. She only reached number 65 in the charts, whereas he started off as 35, then in the second week was number 2, and then in the third week was number 1.
She warmed it up for him.
She really did. Question number 2. In Craig Shemin's book on Sam and Friends, he lists the various musical acts that the Hensons performed in the various incarnations of the show. According to Jane and Jim, Tweedledee, as mentioned in the show, was first performed on Afternoon in 1955 and was the first ever Sam and Friends song. What else did Sam and Friends and J.P. Morgan do as a crossover? A. On December 4th, 1958, the Friends lip-synced to Down by the Old Mill Stream, a barbershop classic as performed by the Morgan Family Singers in 1944. B. On January 16th, 1959, the Friends lip-synced to If It, the B-side on the 1956 single Mutual Admiration Society that Morgan sang with Eddie Arnold. Or C, on September 29th, 1959, the Friends lip-synced to Somebody Else Not Me from Morgan's second solo LP, 1957's The House of J.P. Morgan.
Sticking with A.
No, that's B. Down by the Old Mill Stream was performed on that date, but the Morgan Family Singers have not recorded it. Question number three. According to the Encyclopedia of Television Shows, 1925 to 2010, by Vincent Terrace, what was J.P. Morgan probably best known for to Muppet audiences, having just appeared in it in the years before 1978? A. Rhyme and Reason, a game show where contestants are given the first line of a rhyming couplet. They have to make up what they think the rhyme word is, and if they match the guest host, they get points. B. All-American College Comedy Show, a show where Morgan was the host, and it was a variety show featuring sketch groups from various colleges and universities. Or C. Captain Ahab. Judy Canova and JP play cousins who inherit a New York flat and a lot of money that they can only keep on the condition that they live together and take care of a 97-year-old parrot called Captain Ahab.
Until you got to C, I was convinced I was going to go third time's the charm, A, baby, but I want C to be true so badly, so I'm going with C.
Should have stuck with A.
Yeah.
Rhyme and Reason aired between 1975 and 1976, and she appeared, according to IMDb, on 13 of the 51 episodes. Oh. All-American College Comedy Show is a failed pilot. In 1979, the pilot aired and nothing else. And 1965 was when Captain Ahab never aired. It was also a failed pilot on CBS.
Well, they goofed, because that would be, I want to buy the rights to it and reboot it right now, because that sounds amazing.
These appearances were some of the things that Morgan did to try and recreate herself in the late 60s, early 70s. She was a very well-received popular songstress in the 50s and the 60s, but after that point, she went away and did a number of things to try and reinvent her persona. Coming back in 1969, doing a series of appearances on talk shows as a liberated and edgy woman. All of this led to what she's perhaps most well known for in pop culture, which is a series of affiliations with Chuck Barris. She appeared on a number of the shows that he produced. She was very game for the kind of sexual innuendo he pushed on The Gong Show, and was infamously remembered for a couple of key instances of what was considered to be shocking behavior at the time. All of this happened right after her appearance on The Muppet Show. It's therefore no surprise that she appears in 2002's Confession of a Dangerous Mind. In what manner does she appear? A. She's played by herself at her 2002 age as a hallucination appearing to Chuck Barris when he plays himself in the very end of the movie. B. She's played by Maggie Gyllenhaal in one of the recreations of Barris's Gong Show acts. Or C. She appears in camera through repurposed archive footage, while out of focus in the background are stand-ins in identical costumes.
B.
While Maggie Gyllenhaal is in Confessions of a Dangerous Mind, C is the correct answer. to close out our segment of trivia, as always, we do what J.P. Morgan is most known for on her top four IMDb listings in 6 Degrees of Jim Henson or The Henson Connection. Pete, J.P. Morgan's listings on IMDb are Confessions of a Dangerous Mind from 2002, featuring Sam Rockwell, Drew Barrymore, George Clooney, and Julia Roberts. Night Patrol from 1984, featuring Linda Blair, Pat Paulson, Billy Barty, and Pat Morita. Home Alone 2, Lost in New York from 1992, featuring Macaulay Culkin, Joe Pesci, Daniel Stern, Catherine O'Hara, and nobody else of note. And The Gong Show movie from 1980, featuring Chuck Barris, Jamie Farr, Vincent Schiavelli, and Phil Hartman. Using any of those actors or anybody else who appears in those movies, can you connect J.P. Morgan to Jim Henson in 60 seconds, starting in a minute? Because, Pete, you can get double points if you connect J.P. Morgan through your hated Julia Roberts.
Why's that?
Because you hate Julia Roberts. And so the idea that you could connect her through somebody whose filmography you dislike so much, you deserve double.
Okay.
Starting now.
J.P. Morgan, Julia Roberts. Julia Roberts to... Ocean's 11 is the easy one. Or 12, I guess. She both, I don't know. So we'll go 12... it's one of them. I was going to use Sam Rockwell because he's in Star Wars. But, so at 10 seconds, I'll default back to that. Pretty sure his voice. Pretty sure.
Anyway. 30 seconds.
Okay, Julia Roberts. Cheadle. That should be easy. Brad Pitt. Clooney. I just keep circling back to Spike Jonze because of Confessions. Sam Rockwell, Star Wars, Episode 9, Frank Oz is the voice of Yoda. Frank Oz, Jim Henson, done.
Time. I need proof that Sam Rockwell does a voice in a Star Wars movie.
90% sure on this. Sam Rockwell, Star Wars cameo.
Because I know Daniel Craig does, but I didn't know Rockwell did.
Uh-oh.
The Julia Roberts connection I came up with is that she's in Aaron Brockovich with Albert Finney, who's in Two for the Road with Audrey Hepburn, who's in Sherrod with James Coburn, who's in the Muppet movie. The Oracle at Bacon came up with two better connections than that. Julia Roberts is in The Player with Jeff Goldblum, who's in Into the Night with Jim Henson. And Julia Roberts is in Valentine's Day with Paul Williams, who's in the Muppet movie with Jim Henson. But I would not have gotten either of those. The easy Sam Rockwell connection I came up with was that Sam Rockwell is in movies with Alan Rickman twice. He's in both Galaxy Quest and Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. And Alan Rickman is in the Harry Potter movies with Warwick Davis, who's in the Star Wars movies with Frank Oz. The one I thought you were going to go for is Macaulay Culkin is in Uncle Buck with John Candy, who's in Planes, Trains, and Automobiles with Steve Martin, who's in the Muppet movie with Jim Henson.
Yeah, I can find no proof of my Sam Rockwell theory, but I was certain that that was the case. So as soon as you said Sam Rockwell, I was like, oh, okay, I can do this. Oops.
Other fun connections. Paul Rubens is in Batman Returns with Michelle Pfeiffer, who's in Into the Night with Jim Henson. And Phil Hartman is in Pee-wee's Big Adventure. He also co-wrote it with Paul Rubens. So Paul Rubens is a pretty good connection there. Vincent Schiavelli is also in Death to Smoochie, if you wanted to go that way.
Danny DeVito must be in Death to Smoochie as well, right?
Yeah.
I've seen it once, or I slept through it once. I don't remember much about it.
Really?
Yep.
I thought you were a big fan of that movie.
In theory, I am.
So, with that, I believe you got no correct answers?
Yeah, zero.
Sorry about that.
It's all right.
But speaking of Phil Hartman, one of the ways in which Morgan attempted to bolster and recreate her career is she's in the first major collection of members of the Groundlings, along with Paul Reubens and Pat Morita and various other people. So that 1973 class, which was the major expansion of Groundlings to about 25 to 30 people, and when it sort of went mainstream, she was in that group.
Interesting.
And credits following Phil Hartman to that group and using those techniques later on. So the Groundlings, I think, was part of the explosion of humor that she then was using in this episode and then came to be known for on Gong Show and other TV appearances. I think that was probably the basis for one of the ways in which she was able to successfully reinvent herself as a TV personality, was that training.
That makes total sense because she's so charismatic in this episode, which is why I jokingly said, I don't know if she's an actress or a singer, because she does both fantastic.
For 25 years, she was known as a very clean-cut, well-known 50s and 60s singer. And it was only in the 70s and 80s that she took a step back, reinvented herself, and turned herself into the character that she appears on as the Muppet Show, as a witty, dark personality. And that is the personality that she first manifests when she shows up in the dressing room at the beginning of the episode.
So let's talk about it. We have the return of our regularly timed 15 seconds to curtain. We also have a picture of Fozzie with his hat off, since we've started calling those out.
Mm-hmm. When Scooter comes in and says that, Morgan says, oh, Scooter, I have a little present for you, and tosses a bomb into the hallway behind him. While he's thanking her, the bomb goes off.
First of many explosions in this episode.
And then she turns to camera and says, this is not going to be just a cute little puppet show. Pete.
Yes.
Morgan says that she's acting opposite puppets.
Mm-hmm.
This is a, no pun intended, explosion of the concept of the show. She's fracturing the fundamental illusory reality of the Muppet Show.
Ben, as we've established on the show,
mm-hmm.
we don't see every act that's on the show. She may have done an act with puppets.
Now,
that they just didn't air to us.
There is a guest puppeteer in season 2, much as there were a couple in season 1.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe it happens 2 production episodes prior to this, and we haven't yet seen it this season. So that would have made sense, therefore, for that line to be there. But no, I think she's just subverting the fundamental reality of the Muppets. Now, you have had one or two comments about this in the past, where when we had those guest puppeteers in season 1, Kermit said, we Muppets are very interested in puppets for some reason, and then makes a face. But mm-hmm. you don't frequently have the Muppets actually acknowledge their true selves. In fact, we wouldn't have had a series of episodes prior to this where they all pretend to have feet
mm-hmm.
if we were acknowledging that. So I just want to acknowledge that in the Jim Henson Hour that aired in the 80s, there's a famous behind-the-scenes episode that starts off with the Muppets freaking out because they acknowledge that they are puppets. Somebody says puppet, and I believe it's Gonzo shrinks, oh no, somebody said the P word. And they look down and they see the people beneath them and they have an existential crisis, which then, by the end of the episode, in talking to Jim Henson on computer monitors, they then say, when we look down, we can now see the floor and we can see our feet again. But for a little while there, they were awash with a Being John Malkovich-esque reality.
Speaking of Charlie Kaufman.
Exactly.
The cut to curtain happens at 19 seconds.
Wow.
So,
not great.
Nope. Real far off.
Statler and Waldorf in the opening. Waldorf says, let's get this turkey on the road.
And then Crazy Harry explodes Gonzo for explosion number 2, which I mentioned before in a previous episode. That was reused, but we hadn't seen this one yet.
So the future production episode that we've already seen out of production order was aired earlier.
Yes.
Well, I'm going to posit that even though this may be recycled footage, they re-recorded the sound for this. Because Crazy Harry's laugh in this scene is different than my memory
yeah.
of that other episode. So, or I suppose technically if that was a later production episode, they re-recorded the audio for that one.
Or they may have cut it. He may not have even had the laugh. It would have just been the explosion and then the fade out. But you're right. The laugh was new to me.
Mm-hmm. When we go to the curtain, we have, as mentioned in the trivia, Kermit, after he welcomes us all to another one of those things we call the Muppet Show, he talks about how the very first thing the Muppets ever did was 23 years ago, a musical number called Tweedledee. And now they're going to recreate it tonight with their very special guest.
Well, this isn't just a return of an old segment they've done before. Mm. This is the return of very bad green screening.
You say that, but, well, let's describe it first. We have J.P. Morgan appearing in a freakish bird costume. She's got scarlet feathers coming out of the top of her head and then an orange bird body with her arms constantly flapping in wing motion throughout the entire sketch. But no legs?
No legs.
In a truncated, kind of creepy way.
Yep. Also, what is her belly is constantly moving in a way that is unnatural.
Pulsing.
Yeah.
However, she's singing the song, which was made famous by Elvis, potentially.
Huh.
He released a version of, well, he recorded a version of it in the 1970s that wasn't released until 1984. The version that was done, that I'm most familiar with, and I assume is the one that was done on Sam and Friends, performed by Lauren Baker. I can't read my own handwriting, so that's entirely possible it's not true. I know that version from, let's talk about it again, John Candy and Macaulay Culkin in Uncle Buck. There's a really great use of it on that soundtrack.
Hmm.
And when Morgan sings this, she's very bright, very upbeat, very engaging.
Tweedly, tweedly, tweedly dee. I'm as happy as can be.
At which point, after the first verse, she reverts back to the personality, the darker, more negative, weird personality that she had. But when she first started singing, I was like, what a strange switch from the opening that's almost a sinister, violent appearance. And now we have this crazy bright bird costume against a very bright blue background. I didn't know what kind of impression they were trying to give us of their guest star.
Yeah, I didn't think about it at that moment like that. And then when she starts talking poorly about the act while she's in it, I was like, oh, this is funny, but I still didn't connect it back to that first thing of this isn't going to be your cute puppet show.
Tweedly, tweedly dee, what am I doing here? I mean, this is really corny.
For her to have been in the dressing room, not getting into this costume apparently at all, to then instantly appear in her blue-screened appearance as the bird, for it to be super bright and super cheery, and then during the break after the first verse, she then swings into criticizing everything that she's doing. And yet she never stops flapping. She always maintains the illusion of her being a bird, despite the fact that, aside from the feathers, she really doesn't look like a bird.
Nope.
She looks like a feather-coated chicken nugget with a human face in the middle of it.
That's good. Besides the green screen, my only real complaint with this sketch is that when the bird tells her to modulate, she doesn't. She's singing.
It's not the same key as the previous verse?
No, I think it is the same key as the previous verse.
Okay.
It sounded, and again, I have a very professionally trained ear to music, but it sounded to me like it was the exact same notes that she was just singing. They didn't change anything at all.
I mean, what are you going to ask me to do next?
Modulate, JP, modulate! Woohoo!
Yes, as you say, there's a bird that shows up. The bird thinks she's amazing. The bird is very complimentary of her. She's very dismissive of it. I think that while the appearance of the fluffy bird costume against the background is obviously violating any sense of believability, the thing that they are doing of having the background sway crazily behind her in order to give a sense of her actually flying and being in strange motion, that kind of sickening roller coaster ride is a lot of fun.
Yeah, I mean, if you enjoy
Vertigo,
then yes, I agree with you. It is a lot of fun. But sickening is the perfect word to describe it.
They end the song with her having maybe modulated, essentially dropping off the screen and then appearing in a bush where she then says the word dumb to indicate how she thinks the song and the lyrics have gone. And then it cuts to applause and Statler and Waldorf.
Where Statler, once again, being complimentary to one of our guest stars, says, oh, J.P. Morgan is terrific.
Waldorf says, yeah, but that number's for the birds.
Statler then makes a scrunchy face, wonderfully, and says, oh, you had to do that joke, huh?
And then Waldorf says to the audience, yeah, one of us had to and I lost the toss. So Statler's mad at Waldorf making the joke, despite the fact that they'd already previously agreed
that one had to do the joke.
So the reality of his outrage doesn't last for even a line.
Nope. Nope, not at all.
Also, a lot of two camera so far in this episode.
Yeah.
J.P. Morgan doing two camera in the opening, her then talking two camera in the bird costume and violating the fourth wall, and now Waldorf talking two camera. There's an enormous amount of acknowledging of the audience in this episode, perhaps more than anything we've seen so far.
Yeah. Mentioning that this is a puppet show.
Yeah.
We go backstage, where the bird walks off stage, cheeping very loudly.
The bird is played by Richard Hunt, I believe?
Yes, it was Richard Hunt in this episode. JP follows after the bird. Name is Shirley, by the way.
Okay.
She's still in costume. Kermit tells her that it was a terrific number, which she doesn't believe. She tells him,
thank you, Kermit. Nice of you to say so. I'd like to say I'm really indifferent about being here.
Indifferent?
Yeah, well, you know what I mean.
Great sentence.
He says that last segment was really cute, and she laughs and says, it was cute, wasn't it? And then immediately her face drops, and she grabs Kermit and says, I hate cute.
Kermit's a lot taken aback by this and says, we're in trouble, and then tries to reassure her that, JP, we're not all cute around here, it'll be fine. At which point Animal bursts in, shouting her name, and then there's a, to me, confusing bit of dialogue here.
Oh, JP!
Oh, wait, Animal, JP. Don't do it! Cute's not the only thing I hate!
JP!
Don't do that!
Where when JP says, oh no, and then clutches at her shirt before running off stage, I was pretty sure she was the one who says, don't do it.
I have written down that she says, cute isn't the only thing I hate.
I think she says, don't do it, and then says, cute is the only thing I hate.
Oh.
What is the it that's going to be done regardless? The way in which JP reacts by clutching her shirt and backing away, it sounds problematic.
Well, the way I wrote in my notes about the Animal section was, Animal enters and sees JP and then approaches her in the way only Animal can get away with. Because, yes, Animal seems to be the uncancelable Muppet.
Mm.
He's the one who's allowed to sexually harass and accost any guest star that he wants and continue to be employed.
As JP runs off and as Animal follows, Kermit also decides he needs to follow in order to prevent whatever actionable thing is going to happen and yells out, Chef, you're on. At which point there's a sideways wipe and we go to the Swedish Chef.
Swedish Chef swings his whisk around his knife.
And it flies off the knife in a way that it takes him a second to realize that it's gone.
Yeah, I like that. Chef this week is trying to open a coconut, and after attempting so unsuccessfully by using the knife that he put the whisk around, mm-hmm. and then a saw, and finally he taps it with a hammer, and
I believe it's a Kluber. He's going to Kluber the coconut.
Yep. And then after an awkward cut, the coconut suddenly has a slice down the middle of it, which
is exactly what happens when you tap something with a hammer.
Yep.
It gets a very clean 50% cut through the middle of it, as we all know.
Yeah, making it very easy to open and expose a bomb, which then goes off for explosion number 3.
You watch this with subtitles on.
Yes.
When the Swedish Chef talks, what do you normally get?
Nothing except for the occasional English word. It just says
mock Swedish, yeah, fake Swedish.
Or gibberish occasionally, I think. And then, yeah, the clear words will be subtitled.
How many clear words did you get in this one?
I don't remember.
Okay. The DVDs went for broke this time in terms of trying to produce clear words or what they thought was English.
Interesting.
So while the Swedish chef is doing his normal "Ich vör de kukunut," where he just uses "Ich vör" in front of pretty much everything.
Ich vör de kukunut. Ich vör de open de kukunut. Ich vör de top de bottom.
Suddenly, instead of doing mock Swedish, they then said, it's hard to open the coconut.
It started to translate.
Yes. And then he continued to say, it's hard in the subtitles, despite the fact that he was just going, ich vör, ich vör.
So is ich vör Swedish for?
No.
No.
No, it's not. Because, again, that's what he says in front of everything. It's
everything the Swedish chef does in the kitchen is hard, Ben.
That's true. Then, when he's sawing the coconut, he very clearly has the mock Swedish sazen the coconut,
yep,
which they spell out in the subtitles despite it not being an English or a Swedish word. And then the reason why I knew so much that he had the hammer was a clubber is because they also say gotten the clubber in the subtitles. So while for ages the subtitles have been lousy with absence, suddenly for this one episode,
four episodes left in the series,
they're trying like crazy to come up with approximations of what he's saying. I anticipate that this will exhaust them and it will never come back.
Yeah, I wonder if for some reason their production episodes started with this one and they went, nah, we're done.
Not worth it.
This one took us 45 minutes to do.
After the explosion, we cut to Statler and Waldorf, which begins with Statler, I believe,
yep,
saying, wait just a minute, that's the second time tonight they've used a bomb joke. Isn't it the third time?
It is technically the third time, but I'm going to assume they didn't know what opening credits scene that they were doing.
Oh, you're saying script-wise?
Yes.
They didn't know when they wrote this episode that the bomb was going to be used.
Yeah, and they did the Crazy Harry one and went, oh, there's lots of bombs. We should do it here, too. Which then threw off the logic of...
That's a good diagnosis. Makes more sense than the weird possibility of, despite sometimes we can see things, sometimes we can't, they couldn't see the explosion in the dressing room hallway. Where they could have seen the other two, because they both happened on stage, they could have seen them from the box.
Is Dick Van Dyke ever a guest host on The Muppet Show?
Not that I'm aware of. Why?
Because his diagnosis would be murder.
Well googled. Then Waldorf...
Oh, yeah. Because, yeah, Waldorf reaches up just holding a bomb as it explodes in his hand.
Then...
Waldorf then, after it explodes, Waldorf says, haha, three's a charm. And then Statler once again does scrunchy face.
Yeah. I mean, what a strange reaction to a bomb of just holding it, waiting for it to explode. Yeah. And then
casually raising it up.
Continuing to have dialogue after it. Very different kind of bombs than the other that have been going off so far.
But Ben?
Yeah.
So far, this episode, not bombing.
Then we go backstage where Fozzie is presiding back there. And as the chef staggers past him in the background, he says, that's a bang-up job there, chef, and laughs at his own joke.
It's all a joke. I would, too.
And then starts interacting with Kermit, asking how JP is doing.
Kermit says that she's fine. He just sent up a cake to her dressing room. Fozzie wants to clarify if it was the cake that was sitting here on the table.
When Kermit says yes, Fozzie reveals that that cake was made by Crazy Harry.
And at that moment, the dressing room door blows off its hinges for explosion number 5. JP comes out coughing and asks if they can get back to the cute part.
A line that she delivers very well. Yeah. And then she collapses and her feet go up on the door like she's the Wicked Witch of the West. And it then remains in that position for the remainder of the sketch, which isn't that long.
No.
But it's still a decently long time for her to be like, yeah, I'm just lying here with my legs up in the air in order to make sure that I'm committed to the bit.
Yeah, yeah, it is a good actor's choice that she decided to do instead of just being like, all right, I'm going to lie down. It's a solid, solid moment. Kermit then asks Fozzie to introduce the next number as he tends to JP.
Fozzie then goes out in front of the curtain in order to say that Kermit has asked him to do the introduction, and Statler says,
oh yeah?
Well, he's the only one who does.
Hey, come on, guys. No heckling. I mean, I'm not even out here to tell jokes.
Have you ever been?
Yeah, it's like they're heckling him out of habit at this point.
It's interesting, only in terms of continuity, that last episode we had Fozzie doing stand-up for the first time in a really long time.
Mm-hmm.
And yet this is an episode that in airing order in the United States follows with Fozzie saying, guys, you know I'm funny. And Waldorf says, you're right, I never enjoyed you more than last week. At which point Fozzie realizes, hey, wait, I wasn't here last week. And Waldorf says, yeah, that's why I loved your act so much. But just last week, in terms of air date order,
we saw him doing his roller skating routine.
Correct.
Also, because I noted this as well, in production order, this is true, because the production order episode before this is Julie Andrews, where he was not.
Okay.
He didn't have an act. But for the UK, also untrue.
Okay, because this aired 2 weeks earlier in the UK, aired at the very end of February, February 26th. What was the episode before that?
That's the Bob Hope episode.
Ah.
So Fozzie didn't have a traditional act, but he did appear to let Kermit know that Bob Hope wasn't there yet.
Mm.
Fozzie finally getting through all of this.
I mean, solid work in terms of establishing the feel of the Muppet Show. Like,
mm-hmm.
Fozzie shouldn't be able to go out on stage without them instinctively throwing verbal tomatoes at him.
Yeah.
According to the characters of Statler and Waldorf, he shouldn't be allowed to even be able to get a couple sentences being like, I'm just here to introduce the next act, without them absolutely taking advantage of he's showing weakness by showing up here. Therefore, we have to take him down a peg.
The only time they ever show him mercy is if he's in an ensemble with other Muppets.
Mm-hmm.
But he finally introduces Gonzo the Great, who will be performing a trumpet solo, Flight of the Bumblebee, and at which point Statler says, that does it, I'm leaving.
And that's bizarre considering the continuity of this episode. First of all, in terms of the wider Muppet Show, which, as you remind me all the time, has no consistency or continuity, the fact that Fozzie comes out, they're able to insult him gleefully, but Gonzo performing the Flight of the Bumblebee is the straw that breaks the camel's back and now Statler has to leave is absurd. Like, that shouldn't be the tipping point for anything.
Especially because it's 15 seconds long.
Well, I mean, they didn't know that when it started, but it is
but
certainly...
But the Flight of the Bumblebee isn't a long piece of music,
yep,
generally.
But it's also, it's not, Gonzo will be performing Flight of the Bumblebee while upside down in a vat of honey. It's not something crazy and over the top. It's just, Gonzo will be doing something musical? It's not even a traditional Gonzo act.
Yeah, Gonzo literally is just performing the trumpet.
While Rolf plays the accompaniment on the piano.
Yeah, that was the note I made, was, for a trumpet solo, there sure is an awful lot of piano.
Flight of the Bumblebee, as written by composer Rimsky-Korsakov, is a very, very famous piece. Everybody can sort of instantly hear the opening bars of it. I think that's also helped by the fact that it is the opening of the theme of The Green Hornet by Al Hirt. It then turns into that amazingly propulsive theme song for the rest of the show. But the... You're staring at me with, I have never heard the Green Hornet theme.
Nope.
It's great. It's one of the best television / radio themes ever written. It's amazing.
Never seen the movie, never seen the show, never heard the radio. In general. Never. Never listened to the radio.
But instead of a normal Muppet Show sketch, as you said, 15 seconds long?
Mm-hmm.
This starts right off with everything in place. Rolf at the piano, Gonzo playing, and the escalation doesn't allow time to escalate. there is already a real bumblebee flying around the stage, and Animal is already on stage trying to hit it with a club. So there's no opening bars of the song, and then the bee comes out, and then somebody notices, and then Animal tries to kill it. We start basically in the second and a half act of a normal setup.
It's so much fun.
And do you think it's more fun because there's no rising action? That it cuts straight to, we're doing this?
Well, I mean, as you said about the theme song that I've never heard, it starts so strong that there's no way to escalate anything into it. It just starts.
It's already propulsive and action-oriented.
Yeah. And unlike Moonlight Sonata, everyone does know that this is Flight of the Bumblebee.
Well, they also say it beforehand.
Well, yeah, okay.
Unlike Moonlight Sonata, where they don't tell you what it is, and you're just supposed to know it.
Mm-hmm. So as Animal chases the bee around, he hits, in order, the piano.
Specifically, the prop holding the cover of the piano open.
Rolf 6 times, the piano keys once, and then finally Gonzo, for a total of 9 hits.
Does he ever hit the bee?
No, he does not.
I would just like to say at this point that there have been plenty of episodes in the past where we have not counted inanimate things being hit. For example, we didn't count when Piggy slams an iron into the doors of the Swine Trek while trying to hit Link Hogthrob, and yet we are counting hitting the piano 3 times.
Only twice, but yes. I am counting them all because he is
wielding a club.
And he is attempting to hit the piggy thing.
She was also attempting to hit.
But that was a miss of a different sort for me.
Pete.
Yeah.
If there's anything that this series of podcast episodes has demonstrated,
yeah,
it's that you're wildly inconsistent.
No.
Much as Animal is wildly waving a club around, I don't think anybody expects your totals or rationales to line up from moment to moment.
I think that I am wildly inaccurate, like Animal is. I wouldn't say I'm inconsistent.
So how many hits is that?
9.
Weirdly enough, I just want to mention that when the curtains open on Flight of the Bumblebee, we have one person clapping. There's very clearly solo clapping and nothing else. There's not a cheer. And
Maybe that's Waldorf since Statler just left.
I think that's the implication. But even that is a strange decision because why would Waldorf be excited for any act?
Well, as you said, it's classical music and he's a very old man. He's probably, as they've said, contemporary of that composer.
Probably remembers when it first premiered.
Yeah.
In any case, I just wanted to mention that it's a very strange directorial and production decision that instead of having any of the normal Muppet audience, whom we haven't seen in episodes.
Yeah, weeks.
Applauding, or just no sound at all, there is the very clear laid-in single clap.
It could also be that the audience usually doesn't get Gonzo bits. So it could be that, too, of like, there's going to be one person who's politely going to clap, but usually they're not going to like this anyway. Mm.
So what you're hearing is the deafening silence of most people being like, oh, no.
Yeah.
Oh, no.
Yeah, this is going to be a disaster. And they're not wrong.
I thought you said this was one of your favorite bits.
No. Because it is a disaster in the sense that Animal comes out and ruins everything.
So Gonzo's bit is bad. Animal's bit is great.
No, Gonzo's bit is great.
How many hits?
9. Well then, while you're harping on me for being wrong, let me harp on you for being wrong, because the next segment we have is a traditional At the Dance, which you said we'd never see again.
But it's a new structure.
Is it?
In that
it's still 5 jokes on the same joke.
I think we've only done this once before, which where we had every joke open with, so I says to the waiter, I says. Every one of these 6, not even 5, but 6 jokes is, you see, the problem with, and then it's either women, men, or you. And so it starts off as, an equitable division between women saying what the problem with men is and men saying what the problem with women is, and then it gets increasingly personal from mm-hmm. that. But there is a very quick and efficient way of having these jokes spool one after the other with...
The trouble with you is...
And I think that kind of tight focus hasn't happened except in the So I Says to the Waiter I Says episode. All the other, maybe you would have a commonality, mm-hmm. but the linguistic structure of all the jokes starting effectively the same way.
The trouble with you is...
I think is, if it ever happens again, which apparently I'm claiming, despite having had 4 at the dances this season, is never going to happen. Were it to come back, I would say this would be a killer app of a structure.
I mean, it could be better if Pogo George was in it. Because he's not, still. So you weren't wrong that you when you said we'd never see Pogo George again.
And
that
in fact,
you were right about.
One of the first dancers that we get is Zelda, as Zelda and her singing owl. But who don't we get?
Pogo George.
And?
Mildred.
That's right.
Yeah.
We have a different old Biddy because Mildred is gone.
But we couldn't have George in here because the fourth pair of jokes is obviously Frank.
Yes, it is.
Because it sounds like a drunk Fozzie talking to an uptight piggy.
Trouble with you is you're conceited.
I am not. Although I have every reason to be.
It's a very piggy voice.
And it's a very Fozzie voice.
Of the 6 problem with jokes, are there any of them that jumped out at you?
The only one being the one we have to talk about because it has a statistic attached to it.
Okay.
Which is the 6th and final one, mm-hmm. which is the trouble with you is you're so stubborn you refuse to change. At which point the partner, breaking the fourth wall yet again, mm-hmm. looking directly at camera, explodes, changing into a lizard creature and says, you want to bet?
It's the green frackle. It's the standard green frackle head.
That is our 6th explosion on the 6th joke.
Last time we had an At the Dance, we had a Cyclops joke where the person was facing the other way until it was revealed that they had one eye and turned around. I thought the execution of the 5th joke, the problem with you is that you're always sticking your nose into everyone's business. I knew that that person was going to have a big nose when they turned their head towards the camera. That nose was spectacularly done. That was a very well-engineered puppet.
Yep. I made a note that said the 5th one is fine. We then fade to black and come up on the UK spot that we didn't talk about a few weeks ago.
We talked about not talking about it,
mm-hmm.
but we didn't discuss the particulars of what happens in Thomas Walker's 1728 composition, English Country Garden. Do we want to cover the action, since we didn't previously, as to what happens in this?
We have to, because we intentionally didn't cover it, so that way we could cover it now.
Well, let's just do the essential premise. Fozzie finds himself at Rolf's piano and starts picking out the melody to English Country Garden. And when Rolf says, hey, I didn't know you could play the piano, Fozzie says, I didn't either. And they end up doing a back and forth as they work through the movements of the melody, eventually having 4 hands on the piano playing the different parts. And when you pay attention carefully to the instrumentation of the piece, it's very clear that that very small, does not have 88 keys keyboard, where they're playing on it doesn't match up with the different octaves. But aside from that...
But their rhythm matches.
Their rhythm is very, very good.
Mm-hmm.
Their fingers are absolutely doing a solid job. In the past, we've talked about the fact that one of the reasons why Frank was hired was because Jim needed somebody else who was good enough at faking piano that they could play Rolf together. And so I don't know who are the extra hands in this sketch, because if Frank is Fozzie and therefore one of Fozzie's hands, and Jim is Rolf and one of Rolf's hands, who are the other 2 hands?
Yeah.
In the past, some of the piano stuff has been done by Derek Scott. So there's a chance that Derek is doing 1 or 2 of the hands. But even that, it feels tricky for him to be doing that and then somebody else to be doing the other 2 hands and then Frank and Jim only to be doing the heads. It's possible. In fact, with this much complicated fingering of the piano keys, it might be important to have two real musicians doing it as opposed to the more amateur piano stylings of Frank and Jim.
But I was thinking, you can't do three people, because if you did Rolf left hand head, the person in the middle who would be the left hand and the right hand,
his hands would be in the wrong face. The thumbs would be in the wrong position.
And someone's doesn't have long enough arms to spread out to be on Rolf's left hand and Fozzie's right hand.
Yep.
So unless there was someone doing just the heads and Jim and Frank were both hands.
Mm-hmm.
But I would argue that Fozzie is animated enough and true to Fozzie enough that has to be Frank in that head, too. Yeah.
The way in which he bounces back and forth and nods his head is in perfect timing with the mouth when he's talking.
Yeah, there had to be four people under there.
Together!
Okay. You take it now, okay? Ready? Go!
There's good theme and variations on this. Sometimes Fozzie plays, sometimes Rolf plays, sometimes they play together. And as they're really going for it in the final bars and really tickling up the ivories. By the way, this is the return of the modulate joke.
Mm-hmm. And they actually modulate this time.
Ready? Back. Modulate.
What's that?
So that is a mini runner in this episode, is they have two different songs where somebody yells out modulate like it's a thing that the audience knows what is going on, and B, funny in and of itself. It is, however, a great part of this.
Everything about this is perfect.
It's delightful. And it ends with Fozzie then saying, look out, and doing a glissando down the entire keyboard, knocking both him and Rolf off the bench and onto the floor next to the piano.
A plus.
Yeah, this might be my favorite Muppet sketch of all time.
It's so good. I mean, Flight of the Bumblebee is also excellent, but as I said, it's only 15 seconds long.
Mm.
But lots of highlights in this episode.
We then have, speaking of things I said we'd never see again, a traditional talk spot with the wall.
Mm-hmm. Don't think I was gonna point that out, too.
Look, all I know is what I read at any given time, and at some point I saw a passage in a book that said, at the end of season one, we wouldn't have any more talk spots, and we wouldn't have any more at the dance, and somebody vastly misinformed me.
Maybe they meant at the end of season two. Maybe we'll never see him again next season.
In three more episodes. They certainly are spread out a lot through this. And I will also say, we didn't see the TalkSpot wall for quite some time. We have now seen it twice, and we have seen something that creates a version of the TalkSpot without the TalkSpot wall. But up until two or three episodes ago, this entire season, that was holding true.
It was, and then it all came crashing down.
Or blowing up, as the case may be. We'll see what other misapprehensions have been populated until suddenly I discover that something I said is very much not entirely true.
Well, I mean, Ben, we're only trying to contribute to the common conversation here, so we're not pretending to be experts.
The next segment, as we say, is the talk spot, and it is a traditional interview-looking format with Kermit sitting on the wall, JP sitting at a stool in the nook of the wall. She has changed outfits into a gray, speckled, glittery dress over a maroon-colored shirt and a very flashy black women's fedora with a giant scarlet plume coming out of it. It's super showy. And the camera is back away from the talk spot. Oftentimes when we do the talk spot, last season, it starts in a sort of a medium two-shot, whereas this is further back, almost as if the hat is so big it needs extra camera distance.
JP is concerned with how the show's going, considering she's been attacked and two explosions have gone off around her. Kermit knows that things are going poorly and wants to explain about the explosions.
He doesn't say, so Jim Henson thinks that four things are a great way to end an episode. Having somebody be eaten, having somebody reveal a doppelganger sense of themselves, having an explosion, or what's the fourth one?
1, 2, 3, dip?
It's not, but that's very funny. He does, however, say that explosions are kind of a trademark of the show.
As he says that things blow up all the time on the show, he blows up for Explosion 7.
And then he comes in on the opposite side of the wall, and she turns to him and says, how do you do that? And he goes, oh, it's really quite simple, and explodes, and then another Kermit comes back on the first side of the wall where he was, saying, actually, in fact, it's rather fun. This is obviously where we get the recorded line. The second Kermit after the first explosion, or seventh explosion, is the recorded Kermit. And the way you can tell is that when Kermit comes back on the left side, where Kermit had originally been being puppeteered by Jim Henson, his voice is very excited.
You see what I mean?
Wow. How'd you do that?
Oh, well, it was really quite simple. In fact, it's rather fun.
And it's basically at a level of energy that doesn't match the second explosion Kermit, which means that had to have been done in a pre-recorded line that didn't match the energy of the scene.
Interesting.
They went for something, they hoped they got it right, but that Henson himself had already escalated his performance in such a degree that when he comes back on, he's not matching his pre-recorded version.
She says, I guess you could say that you got a bang out of it.
And Kermit says, you could, but that we did that joke already last year.
I have no memory of that joke.
They did do that joke last year.
Oh, I believe it.
In the Sandy Duncan episode, where in the first opening curtain, Kermit says that the episode is going to be a real bang-up affair. And Crazy Harry says, did somebody say bang? And hits a plunger.
Oh. See, I figured it was going to be more than just Crazy Harry.
No, it's the bit being, well, the language is a real bang.
Yeah.
And that is literally something they said. And that was a Crazy Harry runner in that episode.
I do remember that now. For the first time in these talk spots, reach an awkward pause.
And J.P. Morgan basically says, what should we talk about next?
And Kermit goes, what about your hat? You're known for your flashy hats. Let's talk about that, I guess.
By the way, found no indication in any of my various J.P. Morgling Googling that she's known for her flashy hats.
I was fully expecting a hat.
Flashy hat trivia question.
Yeah.
No, nothing indicates that this is just them yes-anding it in order to go further on with the sketch. Because she says, I especially wanted to wear this hat on the Muppet Show. And when Kermit asks why, it explodes out of the top of the hat.
Which, when she turns to other Kermit, to second Kermit, you can see the device in the top of the hat.
She then says, I guess you could say I blew my top. And Kermit says, yeah, you could, but... And then the two of them in unison say, we did that joke last year. Which is true. They did it in an At the Dance segment on the Mum and Shantz episode, where two puppets dancing together say, I'm going to blow my top. And the other one says, oh, I'll do it with you. And then they both have their heads explode.
I remember that now. Beforehand, no idea. Kermit, basically running out of things to say again, says that the talk spot is just about over. Shall they both leave? And she agrees, sits up straight, and then she explodes and disappears. Kermit laughs, follows suit, also exploding and disappearing for explosions 10 and 11.
I am mildly mystified by the fact that she is able to miraculously have achieved explosion teleportation power despite being utterly flummoxed by it previously when Kermit does it for the first time.
She's a quick learner. She just says,
it's almost like when Kermit is able to very quickly learn how to manifest fangs in the talk spot with Vincent Price.
Exactly.
Statler and Waldorf end up commenting on that sketch. Waldorf says, do you suppose that means we'll never see them again?
Statler says, well, we can always hope.
Hey, they're definitely saying them in that, which means they're saying negative things about the guest star. It's not, we'll never see him again. It's, they don't also want to see her anymore.
Hey, I'm not saying that they've never said anything negative about guest stars. I just think they mostly say positive things.
Yeah, well, at this point in the show, they're apparently worn out. Also, by the way, Statler's back.
Yep.
Just to underscore my earlier point. That lasted for a couple of minutes.
Maybe he just needed to get out of here because he needed to use the restroom or something like that.
I mean, last episode he left in order to go get pizza.
It's true. Pizza.
Then we have what in normal circumstances would be a UK spot, except for when it occurs in the show. And English Country Garden, when it was mysteriously by the DVD company put in the previous episode where it didn't belong, we talked about it at the time of being like, it's weird to effectively have two UK spots right next to each other. It's weird to effectively have two UK spots a sketch apart from each other. But what we have is Floyd playing an upright bass solo and Nigel, the conductor of the pit band, whistling along to it. For how long, Pete?
1 minute, 2 seconds.
Okay, so actually shorter than a normal UK spot.
Yeah.
There are no jokes here. It's just about the physical performance of their ability to mimic it. You have been incredibly critical of Floyd's instrumentation before. How are they doing with the upright bass?
Loved it.
In fact, you have very specifically said in the past, I want the hand to be able to move on the neck.
And they do it, baby.
Good to know that between season one and season two, 45 years ago, they listened to you and figured out what they needed to do in order to make you happy.
Hey, we're just out of the top 1,000 best TV recap podcasts. Of course they're listening to us.
Our influence is magnificent. It ripples back through time.
I think that if they were to do this segment today, Nigel would be Walter.
Well, I was thinking about Whistling Muppets, and Walter is obviously a very key one. There's also, in the introduction to Muppets Tonight, one of the band members on the show that they're doing in their late night pastiche is a prominent Whistling Muppet that looks sort of like a California raisin, and he walks past during the bit going... And both Walter and whoever that guy is have puckered lips, whereas what they've done with Nigel is they're curving the top of his mouth down in a in an upside-down U.
Mm-hmm.
It's effective.
Yep.
It doesn't look unnatural, except that I can picture newer Muppets who had a slightly more realistic version of what to do with your mouth.
But those Muppets were also designed with that purpose in mind, correct, where Nigel has been used for nearly 40 episodes at this point, if not longer.
Pete, what can you tell me about the music that they're playing? I did not look this up.
Oh, well then, let me click on the link. According to the fandom page, it's called Big Noise from Winnetka.
Okay.
It is apparently written by Ray Bowdick, Bob Crosby, Robert Haggart, and Gil Rodin from 1938. And it's an instrumental piece, an improvised composition that was created at a live performance by Ray Bowdick and Bob Haggart when they were members of the Bob Crosby Orchestra. Haggart whistled while Bowdick played on the bass with his drumsticks.
So this is an actual recreation of an improvised jazz tune, and somebody liked it enough in order to say, I wonder in which order it happened. If they liked the jazz piece and they're like, let's just do a minute from this because it's fun, or if somebody was fooling around with Nigel and thought, oh, this kind of looks like whistling, you know, there's this great piece where somebody whistles in it.
Wild speculation time? The first.
It's funny. I would have wildly speculated the latter.
That's why we make a good team, Ben.
And since we will never know, we also have to have achieved detente between the two of us.
Yeah, this is catchy as hell. So at the end of it, Nigel walks back towards the back and gets quieter as he gets farther away from us. And I was expecting...
a phenomena rush to the camera.
Yeah, but that doesn't happen. He just kind of stays back there as the song ends.
They do one call and refrain at the front of the camera. They then do another one with him back. That's the end of the piece.
Yep. 1 minute, 2 seconds.
From there, we go to Pigs in Space. Our introductory words for the crew are fatuous, recalcitrant, and describable. Again, with a, I'm going to forget the phrase, an inverse positive. That's not it, but it's close to that. Instead of indescribable, that it would be normally the thing that you would say about somebody in order to make them mysterious and interesting. Describable is a perfectly normal word. It's just not something you'd ever say about somebody.
Yeah, because you'd, if they were describable, you'd have other words to describe them.
Either way, as you've just underscored, it's funny.
Yeah.
And when we last left the Swine Trek, it was in serious danger as it plummets towards Earth at an alarming rate. I had no idea that the 5-year mission to explore strange new worlds brought them so close to Earth.
Well, as you just said, we don't know. The pigs might not be Earth pigs.
Oh, the Swine Trek could be alien pigs that are now coming to Earth.
Yes.
Oh, interesting. I mean, they do know what a payphone is.
Uh-huh. Doesn't mean there aren't payphones on their planet, their pig planet.
The parallel evolution of pig planet could have produced payphones.
They, good one. They were shocked when John Cleese, a human, boarded their ship. Yes. That was an alien.
I think it was more that he was a pirate.
Yeah, but...
A pirate and a payphone on the ship of the pig planet.
With a parrot.
That's right.
Perilously.
You were very punctual in achieving that phrase.
Potentially.
Well, we then have Link repeat the Frary phrase from the voiceover, and we get to Dr. Strangepork explaining that one of the engines has plain old fallen off, so they can't fix it. By the way, in the opening and closing shot of the Swine Trek, all four engines are totally there. But he's done the calculations, and they need to jettison some weight, and if they get rid of one pig, that should do it.
Then we've seen other pigs on this ship.
That's right.
It doesn't need to be one of the three main pigs.
It's true. We definitely only occasionally see random other pig crew members. In this case, when Piggy shows up, they look at each other with the knowledge of, well, this is the pig we're going to get rid of. Because it falls into the classic sexist pattern of she's disposable. I find that remarkably short-sighted on their part, in that she clearly is being used by them the way they have used her in the past, of doing all the domestic chores on the Swine Trek. If they get rid of Piggy...
They have to do the laundry.
They have to do the ironing. They have to do the cooking. They have to do the things that they've been passing off on her previously. The most current one that she walks on having just done is the laundry. And I wanted to point out that it is very stupidly short-sightedly male of them to be like, oh, let's get rid of the chick because then we can go back to being the bro Trek. But that will mean that they'll be living in their own swill and filth very soon thereafter.
They're pigs. I like that, though.
Apparently not, if they're having her do the laundry.
Yeah.
Unless she's washing them in a special pig mud non-cleaner, something to filth them up. Piggy initially hopes that this means that she's going to be given a very special assignment, and when Link reveals to her that they need to jettison something, she's like, and you need me to help you decide what to get rid of. She's very enthusiastic about having anything remotely close to being an influence on the ship.
Yeah, he breaks the news to her. And as she's about to hi-yah him, he pulls a lever that opens a trap door and yells, "Ah-bah-pah, fatso."
Well, he doesn't yell that until he closes the hatch. The problem is that the lever that he pulls to close the hatch, and previously Strangepork has said, you can't get rid of me, I'm the only one who knows what all these science equipment does.
Yep.
Which therefore allows it to be very good that when Link pulls a lever, he doesn't understand what it does. And closing the hatch also brings Piggy up directly behind him. The other reason why Strangepork had to leave, so that there was an opening for her to pop back up.
Yeah.
She then proceeds to successfully hi-yah him.
And then stomping him twice for hits 10, 11, and 12.
So, Pete, in previous episodes,
yeah,
you have said that stomps that happened off-screen that you couldn't see didn't count.
No. I've always counted the second Piggy stomp. It's when they happen off frame that they don't count. If you can see her go up and down after a hi-yah, that is always counted and always will count.
Listeners, feel free to write in if that's not true.
It's 100% true.
I'm sure you are as consistent in this as in all things.
I would never only count music sometimes also.
I would not always sometimes include certain themes and not others.
Maybe the Swedish Chef has an 11-second intro this time, and the Pigs in Space has a 33-second intro, and Sam the Eagle has a 6-second intro.
That in previous episodes were not part of the calculation.
Swedish Chef has consistently been this season, and Pigs in Space always has. Mm. I don't think I've done Sam the Eagle all the time.
What about Muppet Newsflash? Does the did it count as music?
Never been counted. Consistently never been counted.
Well, after Pigs in Space, we go to a Muppet Newsflash, where we once again have a drop things from the air on the studio. This comes right after we've been jettisoning things out of the swine track. However, this is a completely different jettisoning that's taking place here, where a charter flight by the London Symphony has been forced to get rid of some of its musical instruments. And the timing of him saying that and then starting the next sentence, he gets to the word that, and then the piano lands on him. It's some of the best comic timing ever.
I also like how the piano takes out the phone that's on his desk, too.
I mean, dropping a piano on things is such a fabulous cartoon cliche that it's how Eddie Valiant's brother is killed in Who Framed Roger Rabbit. And yet, obviously, something was going to happen when you said jettison and flight in the intro. But piano and the timing of it, the combination of those two things, made me startle laugh at this.
Yeah, it's great.
Then we go backstage, and shocker, J.P. Gross is backstage being shown around by Scooter.
He says he's going to take a look around and then decide if he's going to get rid of Kermit or not.
And as he wanders off and Kermit comes on, Scooter gives the audience the exposition, again, that we've just received a couple lines earlier, as to who he is and why he's here. But the purpose of this is to set up the traditional person hears somebody talking about them while they don't know that they're being overheard sketch, except it's name confusion because Kermit's talking about J.P. Gross while J.P. Morgan overhears and thinks she's being talked about when he's saying negative things about Gross.
Yeah, as he's complaining about her, JP enters from a non-exploded dressing room.
That's right. Although the door has been fixed on the other dressing room, they still decided to move her either because it works better on camera or because that's where they normally have guests come out of in order to walk down the stairs, and they just did the other room for some explosive reason.
And two bombs had gone off in that door.
Yeah. Even though they may have fixed the door, the insides may
be probably very smoky and balmy. She comes down the stairs overhearing Kermit. As she confronts him about it, he realizes a mistake, tries to explain himself.
The language here is great. He says, oh, JP, oops. Oh, I didn't mean you, JP. I meant JP, JP.
Hey, Ben.
Yeah.
How many times is the name JP said in this sketch?
I don't know. How many?
13. From start to finish, 13.
As he's then defending himself and saying that all the negative things he was just saying about how JP is the worst, he's saying that about JP Gross. So he now has his back to the stage where Gross has walked off. So now he's inevitably going to come up behind Kermit while Kermit's saying negative things about him. But true to character, JP Gross says, I hope you mean all that as a compliment, Frog. Because he is a nasty piece of work, and he would like those terrible things being said about him, which I think is a nice reversal.
Mm-hmm.
It's a good twist on this whole sketch, which is a very old sitcom setup that I'm normally not a fan of, except the JP-ness of it is amusing, and I like the fact that they figured it out.
Yeah, this whole episode is very sitcom-y, because that Pigs in Space is the most sitcom-y Pigs in Space we've ever seen, too. It's almost like it stands for situational comedy. And they keep putting these Muppets in situations and hoping comedy comes out of it.
Well, having them be in situations is more than sometimes happens where they just have premises as opposed to it actually being a setup. the Phantom of the Muppet Show springs to mind.
Mm, true.
JP and JP align themselves in their dismay and disgust and form a wall of dissatisfaction with Kermit. And Kermit sort of wilts and says, I think I just put both feet in my mouth.
Do you think with that many JPs together that that part of the Muppet Theater annexed itself and became part of Jamaica Plain in Boston?
I don't, but only because I like to say no but to things.
I'm just saying that's a lot of JP in one spot.
I would have yes-handed it if I could have come up with something else, but I just plain couldn't.
Just played. Well played. Just played.
We then, as you mentioned earlier, have Sam's editorial. Another thing I said we were done with, and yet has mysteriously come back.
But maybe this time it's the last time, because Sam's talking to us about crime, and a bunch of burglars come in and steal things. And yeah, eventually escalating to stealing the seal, the pillars, the podium, and eventually Sam himself.
The initial, speaking of Who Framed Roger Rabbit and cartoons... The initial reveal of the criminals is when Sam says, I'm here to talk to you about crime. They all stick their heads out from behind the pillars in a uniform slapstick way. And it is a great but obvious gag. But the obviousness of it did not reduce its effectiveness at all.
No. And I really liked when they go to steal the podium because they being
lectern, a podium is a platform you stand on.
You're right.
Oh, I know. You just happen to have walked into one of my pettist peeves.
Listen, Ben, if you're going to be a podium pedant...
From the Pigs in Space Planet?
Yep.
As they tap him on the shoulder so he looks behind him, and then they take the lectern out from in front of him.
Yeah, that's what I was saying, the podium.
You want to start that sentence and not cause me to have to stop it again?
No, I think we've covered it.
So you didn't have one further point to make?
Probably not.
Then let us push on. To Statler and Waldorf commenting on that by saying, I now realize what television has that is a major advantage over a stage show.
Waldorf wants to know what that is.
And Statler says, TV, you can turn off. That joke is perhaps the wrong one to have done when Statler has previously said, that's it, I'm out of here. That's what you do with a stage show. You can't turn it off, but you can just leave.
I thought the same exact thing. Not realizing that he did try and leave earlier in the episode. Like, that would have been another way to play it. Would have been, I tried leaving, they wouldn't let me, or something like that.
Just when I think I'm out, they pull me back in.
Yep. But nope, just TV you can turn off.
When we go back to the backstage segment, we have the bandits carrying Sam off in the background, and Kermit yells after them, hey, you guys better return that eagle! Which, we often talk about how many of the sketches are supposed to go that way. We have, in fact, talked about it in this very episode in terms of Statler and Waldorf and the terrible joke that Statler gets mad at.
Yep.
That was a planned bit, and yet he got mad at it. The destruction of Sam's editorial seems to have been something that wasn't anticipated because... Sam being carted off by the bandits is something that Kermit seems to be worried stealing Sam wasn't part of the plan.
Yeah.
Or else he wouldn't be yelling at them to bring him back. So there's always this strange mix of what is anticipated, what is part of the action, and what has gone wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Another example of that is when in the Peter Sellers episode, everything goes wrong to the point that Kermit does It's Not Easy Being Green.
Yep.
And the weird tension of was Fozzie invested in having that happen or not. Here, Sam's editorial could have been something that was always supposed to happen that way. But Kermit gives us the impression that it was an accident. Except that doesn't bother him. It doesn't bother him that this sketch that was supposed to happen was truncated or their props and materials went missing. He has monsters who are fast enough that they can set up a stage in a half of a second and yet not fast enough to stop a bunch of bandits from carting off the materials.
Well, I mean, Sam and Kermit have a contentious relationship.
That's true. Is.
So I appreciated the fact that Kermit wants Sam back because he says... return him in about 30 days, which, considering this is the last episode before another lengthy break we're about to go on, We'll see if he comes back to the next episode or not.
But it will have been about 30 days before the whole show returns.
Yep. So we'll see if I remember that in 30 days when we have that episode.
Scooter then comes on because we are going to continue the JP bit of this. And he asks Kermit what the closing number of the show is going to be. Again, helping reinforce the we're not quite sure what's going on. Scooter the Gopher is kind of the de facto stage manager. He's often the person that Kermit is yelling for in order to let people know what's going on. Scooter doesn't know. He's too busy tailing his uncle around in order to actually know what's going on the show he's normally helping produce.
Well, Kermit's the worst stage manager of all time, so he does a bad job telling his second in command what's next, clearly. Kermit tells him what the next number is going to be, and he hopes it's great because they've been a little rough on their guest star tonight. Mm-hmm.
But he does say that what they're going to do, they think is perfect for her. And he says, I only hope she'll do it. They haven't even pitched it to her yet. That's how badly organized this show is. They want to do one last big thing with the guest star. They haven't told her what they want her to do.
And she's going on stage in 45 seconds.
That's right. Which is the way in which John Cleese doing To Dream the Impossible Dream. He learned about it after hearing the 8-bar intro. He did not know or have any preparation for his big closing number. J.P. Morgan's going to learn about her big closing number seconds before it happens, and they're going to get a yay or nay of, do you want to perform it?
Yeah, and hopefully it's something she knows, because otherwise she'll have to Bob Hope it and read it off cue cards.
Hopefully, indeed.
Ooh.
But there's extra confusion here because
In saying all the JP's hoping that she'll do it,
JP Gross is totally oblivious to the number of pronouns that have just been used and just says, I'll do it if the price is right.
And Kermit realizes that he's done a bad thing. And just as Hogthrob had to break bad news to Piggy, Kermit tells Scooter, why don't you go introduce this while I break the bad news to JP Gross?
I think that this is the best example of Gross living up to the character that Scooter has always talked about him as. Of, gee, my uncle really likes this, therefore you better do it.
Mm.
Now his uncle is here saying, I sure would like this.
And if so, the price is right.
Even without the money, he's still leaning on Kermit saying, you know, this is the thing I would like to do. I'd like you to totally change everything you were going to do because of my whim.
Always wanted to sing.
Oh boy, having two JPs around is really rough.
Glad you recognize talent, kid. Maybe I'll let you keep the theater.
I think this is the most in-character J.P. Gross has been in his four appearances prior to this point, in this moment, in this scene.
Yep.
Which is another way of saying, I really hate most J.P. Gross appearances. He wasn't the worst in this episode.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there is something about the writing of him that has been a little bit different in this. And maybe it just worked better in terms of how he'd been presented in the prior Scooter talking about him moments, that this felt more consistent with what we'd come to expect from him.
I think it's, as you were saying, though, it's partially because he's being despicable, but he's not being destructive. Because,
even though he came here specifically to find an excuse to fire Kermit.
Yeah, but in this moment,
yep,
he doesn't mention anything other than
money
or the game
pleasure.
Of, yeah, I want to do this, let me do
I
this.
I want.
Yeah, let me. So I think that's less
You think he wanted to perform Motorhead?
Yes, Ace of Spades specifically.
Wasn't sure I was going to be able to pull off that reference.
I was proud of you.
So, for the second time in the episode, Kermit is having to deal with an unexpected crisis off stage, and so somebody else is introducing something on stage, although Scooter doesn't get heckled by the boys in the box. And so when he just says, ladies and gentlemen, here is
the wickedly talented J.P. Dazeem.
She comes out and does the previously announced Old Black Magic. This is a song that was written by Johnny Mercer in 1942. He specifically composed it with the hopes that Judy Garland would perform it, and she did in later that year. This song was used in Sam and Friends in 1959, based on a 1958 Louis Prima and Kelly Smith recording, with two puppets, the traditional wooden-headed Sam and a female version of Kermit as puppeteered by Jane Henson that I believe is called Kermina.
Nice.
So she is doing the Kelly Smith parts, and but it is interesting to see effectively Kermit in a wig with a female vocalist's lip sync part behind him in the footage of the sketch.
She's singing with the big band version of Dr. Teeth. And
although
the
a slightly different big band version than we had previously, because while we do have Bobby Benson playing the trumpet, instead of the pit band trumpeteer, who we'll see in the end credits, we have a different backup trumpeter than was in the big band in the previous episode. So they didn't like that trumpeter enough to keep him around, but they still didn't like the woman trumpeter that's part of the pit band enough to let her be part of the ongoing trumpet performances. I don't know what's going on with the Muppet fabricators and their various trumpeteers, but they're auditioning and dismissing about as many trumpeteers as women on this season of the Muppet Show.
Hey, Louise is stuck around and just still not getting credited. It's the 70s, it's fine.
It's a valid criticism from 45 years later, or at the time. Anyway, as you say, there's a big band backing, but instead of Dr. Teeth being in the band, he zooms on stage to sing along with Morgan. And they do effectively the Smith and Louis Prima duet.
In a spin, love that spin I'm in. Under that old black magic collar.
It's a lot of fun.
Really?
I liked it.
You frequently dislike Dr. Teeth.
Yep.
And you often dislike him because of his weird long arms.
No, I like his weird long arms.
And the way in which they play the piano.
But they're not playing the piano at this moment.
They are groping is the wrong word, but manhandling J.P. Morgan. And they do a lot of singing directly into each other's faces. And periodically, Morgan goes from just singing and performing and having a good time to doing an impression of Dr. Teeth right to his face.
Mm-hmm. She's really good at mirroring. There's lots of near kisses in this, but I only counted one actual kiss.
I think there are two, because there are two instances of the chorus where the lyrics say to kiss, and then in each of those, they go in for a kiss but don't actually kiss, and then she plants a kiss on him afterwards.
In the first instance of the chorus, that does happen. In the second instance of the chorus, it's a miss.
Even though she pulls him in for a real kiss after the
air
kiss. Okay. Yeah.
So it's a miss. Hmm. And at the very end, when they're celebrating, she kisses his open mouth.
Yes.
Which there's no lip contact because his mouth is so big that her mouth doesn't touch any part of his mouth.
That her face is in the space in between his jaws.
Because it's contained within.
The Dr. Teethness of it all.
Mm-hmm. It's wild and I loved it. But not a kiss.
Fair enough. We go back to the curtain, and as you said, in the talk spot, they kind of ran out of things to say, and I've been talking about how Kermit's intros and outros have gotten increasingly abstract, and this is no exception, where he's once again ending the show by saying, I guess we're going to end the show?
Well, we started this some time ago, and it has to end someplace, so this must be the place.
He introduces and wants to thank J.P. Morgan, and she says that despite being blown up, beaten up, and insulted, she had a great time.
Then J.P. Gross rushes the stage. He says for his first song, he'd like to thank all of the boys down at J.P. Gross Collection Agency. And then starts singing, Gimme That Money.
And eventually get shoved off stage as the credits roll.
J.P. Morgan is doing some interesting miming in here, in that she is looking for a reaction from side to side on stage. Eventually, this makes a certain amount of sense because Fozzie and the other puppets come on. But prior to that, I think what's actually happening is she's anticipating that they're going to dub in applause, and then they don't. Because obviously, all of the laugh track is added in afterwards, and that includes the applause as well. And so I think they've told her, there will be a moment here for you to react to, and they just don't match her improv acting as to what the reaction of the audience would be.
Mm-hmm. After the credits roll, we have one last Statler and Waldorf, where Statler says, I wonder if anybody watches this show besides us.
When he notices that Waldorf is sleeping on the lip of the box,
he corrects himself and says, besides me. End of episode.
I think I've been keeping track of how many hits and explosions we've had, but since you've been so wildly inconsistent about it, those numbers could have changed in the last 15 minutes. So why don't you recap how many kisses, how many explosions, how many hits, and any other statistics that you've been accumulating over the course of the episode and the series?
We are at 13 hits this episode, 11 explosions, and one human Muppet kiss. That is not the highest number of explosions we've had this season.
Really?
Yeah, I thought this was gonna take it, but no, we have the Rich Little episode had 12 explosions, and the Nancy Walker episode had 14 explosions. I'm fairly certain the Nancy Walker episode is the episode with the cannons.
Ah, yes. Which you initially didn't think of were explosions, but then we talked you around.
Yep.
Because you're consistent.
Never said anything otherwise. This is the most number of hits we've had in an episode.
This season.
Yeah, definitely not ever, because that's never going to be beaten by episode one.
That's right.
I remembered that.
Landmark in many ways.
Yeah. We've had three episodes with 10 hits each.
Mm.
This is the highest at 13 now. As far as music goes, bottom-ish percentage, 10.91 minutes out of 26.5 minutes for 41.17%. We've had a few in the 30s.
Right.
But the next closest is the Edgar Bergen episode with 10.95 minutes at 41.48%. As for where this episode ranks...
In terms of the guest.
Last week, I talked about we had some spots open. Ben, did this fill a spot or did things move?
Well, I don't mean to impugn your consistent reputation, but you're a lazy, lazy boy.
You're not wrong.
I think this filled a slot.
Things moved.
Hey!
I put her at 4. I really liked everything that she did. I say that as I go, I didn't love Tweedledee, but I do like Tweedledee. Like,
I think the song's catchiness goes a long way, even though the physical manifestation of the sketch is bizarre to the point of almost being a war crime. I think that her vacillation between performing it eagerly and hating what she's doing, plus the melody itself, makes it winning.
Yeah, it's definitely my least favorite moment of hers in the episode. But yeah, I'd still watch it again. She's having so much fun, and she's doing a really good job at what she's doing. Yeah, I had to give her a very, very high ranking.
So who was in 4 previously?
Uncle Milty. So
what was previously open?
6.
That's what I thought.
6, 8, 12, and 14 were open. So now 8, 12, and 14 are open. So I moved Milton down to 5 and Dom DeLuise into this open 6 slot. Having no knowledge of who she was, I had a blast with her in this episode.
She has done the impressive thing that has been very hard in our estimation to achieve, which is to be grumpy about being on The Muppet Show and still be engaging and fun.
Because when she's, even though she doesn't want to do it, she's giving it her all.
That's right. While she's doing it, she's not going through the motions where it's like, ugh, I hate being here. She's doing it. She's getting caught up in it. And then she complains about what's going on. Mm-hmm. But it's only complaining about it in her quieter moments or when she has a moment to catalog all the bad things that have happened to her, which she does twice. But at the same time, she herself says, but I'm still having a good time.
Mm-hmm.
And that comes out in her performance.
Yeah, it's great. While we're talking about great things, why don't I start us off with our first moment?
Please.
In the Fozzie segment, when he's been asked to introduce the next segment, and Statler and Waldorf are heckling him.
Yeah.
When Waldorf says,
I never enjoyed you more than I did last week.
Mm. Oh, I didn't do an act last week.
I rest my case.
Statler falls out of his chair laughing. And I loved it. One of my biggest and favorite memories ever is going to see Hot Rod in the theaters and falling out of my chair laughing and embarrassing the two people I went with. So to see someone slide down into their chair and just rolling around at the joy of what their cohort said really tickled me, and I thought it was a very good performance choice.
It's also amusing that, as you say, they're getting more enjoyment out of each other than they are out of anything that's happening on stage. That they come here night after night. Really, that's the answer to the question of why do we always come here? I guess we'll never know. Yes, they do. It's because they enjoy the jokes they make for each other. Even though they started off by saying, I can't believe you made that stupid joke. They are the people who entertain each other best. And that's why they come back and back and back, is to think each other are funny in hating this show so much. For my second moment, your third moment, I'm going to talk about English Country Garden and allow you to then follow up.
Oh, I understand now. I was like, no, this isn't our third moment.
I suspect it might be, depending on whether I steal your precise moment.
Because we didn't talk about it, so of course we're going to talk about it right now. Fozzie's hat.
That's right. Fozzie's hat is a really great, obvious joke, in that as Fozzie has been bopping his head along, playing the music and enjoying himself, he headbangs so much that his hat falls off into the four hands on the piano. And he then says, oh, my hat. And Rolf picks the hat up as they continue to play and throws it behind him. And then, once he's gotten rid of the hat, asks Fozzie, can you play hatless?
Oh, my hat!
Hey!
What do I do?
Can you play hatless?
What?
I say, can you play hatless?
I don't know who wrote it.
Keep playing!
Yes, sir.
And then they do the Milton Berle thing where they repeat the joke in order to create the timing to be perfect. Instead of just going straight to the punchline, they increase the tension of, we're going to do this dumb joke that you can see coming. And Fozzie says, I don't know who wrote it. Fozzie, who literally didn't know he could play the piano 2 minutes beforehand, is now saying, maybe if I know who wrote a song, I can tell you if I can play it or not. The internal logic of it is so inconsistent. I'm sure you love it that much. But it's such a fantastically constructed and timed joke.
It's so good that the first time I saw it, I thought it was an improvised moment.
Mm.
And it wasn't until the can you play hatless, who wrote it, that I was like, oh no.
This is all set up.
Yeah, this had to have been completely written. Which also, when you know that and rewatch it, you can see Frank, like, he tries to get the hat to fall off at least once unsuccessfully. And then it's like, nope.
I don't think that's what it is. I think it's that he's creating a physical behavior so that when he does it, so that it does fall off, it's been consistent with what he's playing.
Yeah, true. But I do feel like it may have been...
Gosh darn it, I can't get this damn hat off.
Yeah, once. It's so good. So yeah, you were right too. That was absolutely going to be one of my moments. Instead, for our third moment, my second third moment, our middle moment, I want to talk about JP's song.
Oh, again. Interesting.
It was so good.
So I gave you the opening lyric, or I gave our audience the opening lyric. What are the follow-up lyrics?
Yeah, me not money. Can't get enough. Just keep sending that greenbacks.
Just keep sending that greenbacks. Unintelligible. Money, just keep it coming. Hey, yeah, money. And then I think a little bit of scatting. As he's pushed off stage.
Pink Floyd ain't got nothing on J.P. Gross.
Yeah, it's so atonal, but yet good. And it's so on brand that he's singing about money, greenbacks. I watched it about 10 times and trying to write down what he was saying because it wasn't all captioned.
Yeah.
Hence, one of the words being unintelligible to me. Every single time it was enjoyable to me.
For my second moment, our penultimate moment, I'm going to talk about the Pigs in Space sketch. I've talked a couple of different times about Dr. Strangebork. I think he is the secret funniest bit of Pigs in Space.
Well, he is describable.
But his pathetic wheedling and the way in which he so desperately cozies up to his captain.
Rather drastic, isn't it?
Oh, I wasn't thinking of you, Link. You're the captain.
Well, then perhaps it isn't so drastic.
Has been a plot point several times. And so for him to, in this one, just absolutely throw Piggy under the bus or allow Link to pull a lever to throw her under the spaceship. He's such a spineless little slime ball. But the way in which he goes,
I'll see you later, Link. Bon voyage, Miss Piggy.
Made me laugh. Piggy's line in response to it of also weird exit line is particularly funny. Also to camera.
Yep. Oh, that's right.
But his wormy little, I'm out of here, it's not my responsibility, is absolutely in character and delivered very well.
Wait, what does he say to her?
He says, bon voyage.
I think he says, au bon pan.
So you're saying that both Link and Dr. Strangebork say, au bon pan, that mean two totally different things in this?
Ben, all French is just people saying au bon pan.
And all Swedish is just ich bär?
Yeah.
I got it now.
For my third moment, our fifth moment, and final moment of this episode, I said a lot of nice things about J.P. Morgan. I want to say another thing about J.P. Morgan that we've already talked about because it was so good, which is when that dressing room door blows off the hinges and her leg goes up in the air.
Hey, Kermit, can we get back to the cute part?
It's, as I said earlier, such a strong and good choice for her to make of not just deciding to lay down. And just one last little thing that really is a little bit of extra paprika on the sandwich.
She also plays the getting blown up really well. Mm-hmm. Like, she's not just finding extra comic energy in that leg bit, but she's also playing the scene at the exact right pitch of,
I just got blown up.
This knocked me for a loop, but also I'm not in pain or this isn't going to make the kids scared.
Yeah.
She's found the cartoon woozy perfect level for it.
She's playing it like drunk.
I just got my bell rung.
Yeah, but nothing's actually wrong here. And she's right because everything is right with what she's doing. Congratulations on number four, JP. You earned it. This episode of The Hence Perspective was researched, performed, and edited by Ben Russell and Pete Russell. Sound design such as it is, also by the two of us.
Our logo is based on designs by Liana Emily. Thank you, Liana. Music in the episode comes from archive.org and archival Hence and Associate clips of Silver and Cones, Yes, We Have No Bananas, under what we sure hope is transformative fair use, much as the Hensons did when they first broadcast to Sam and Friends.
You can find us at farceperspective.com and follow us on Twitter at @FarceToNameBasis. This podcast, as conceived of by Nathan Emily and Ben Russell, is an intellectual exploration of the lasting power of comedic phenomena.
All excerpts in the podcast are used for the purposes of review. There are things, dates, facts, names, Swedish subtitles, or data of any kind that you feel is incorrect, please contact us via the website and we'll post it to our errata page on farceperspective.com as soon as possible.
Again, our discussion is purely in the name of academic interest and contributing to the common conversation. I'm Pete, my co-host is Ben.
Weird exit line.
And we'll see you in May when we discuss Season 2, Production Episode 20, guest starring Petula Clark.